KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
If you're running in fear of your own voters, there is nothing America can do for you.
At the Munich Security Conference, Vice President J.D. Vance warns European leaders of the threat from within.
For Friday, February 14th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, Deborah Rutter gives her first interview since she was fired as president of the Kennedy Center.
I asked her reaction to President Trump calling the center woke.
All artists, as all Americans, have the freedom of expression. And it is really important to be able to tell those stories.
And finally, a love connection? Probably not, but connections across political parties? Maybe.
Wouldn't it be just fun to just distribute some Valentines and maybe spark some conversations across the aisle?
Valentine's Day at the Wisconsin Capitol Building.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump's cost-cutting assistant Elon Musk is moving fast and, by his own admission, maybe breaking some things in the near term. But what is clear is that Musk's Doge Group is putting in place deep cuts at federal agencies, with the Pentagon also on the block. More from NPR's Tom Bowman.
Doge officials, I'm told, start showing up at the Pentagon today and will work well into next week. And there's a memo circulating that's calling for 8% cuts at the Defense Department. Now, we're not certain if that's going to start at the Office of Secretary of Defense, which includes thousands of employees, or if that 8% is also for all the armed services. And that could include not only personnel, but weapon systems and so forth. We're also hearing that the Navy could be in a position for more funding because Trump officials want to build more ships to keep up with China.
Trump administration's already fired the top officer at the Coast Guard, Admiral Linda Fagan, citing what they called leadership failures, including her focus on DEI initiatives. A D.C. federal judge says the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau cannot terminate any employees unless it's for cause related to specific employees' performance or conduct, and also said the agency cannot issue any notice of reduction in force. The order from Judge Amy Berman Jackson comes after members of Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency team were apparently given access to key systems. Judge Jackson also says the agency cannot delete or remove data held by the CFPB. The order comes as CFPB staff were bracing for mass layoffs after the agency, under Acting Director Russell Vogt, fired more than 100 workers earlier this week. Hamas now says it will release three Israeli hostages tomorrow as part of its ceasefire agreement with Israel. Three include an American citizen and a Russian citizen. In exchange, Israel will release hundreds more Palestinians. NPR's Daniel Eshton reports from Tel Aviv.
American Sagi Dekel Chen is among the hostages to be released tomorrow. In exchange, Hamas expects Israel to release 36 Palestinians convicted for deadly attacks against Israelis and to release more than 300 Palestinians arrested in Gaza during the war. Earlier this week, Hamas had said it would delay the hostage release, alleging ceasefire violations by Israel, which Israel denied. The dispute was resolved. Keith Siegel, an American hostage freed this month, credited President Trump with his release.
President Trump, you are the reason I am home alive. Your leadership and strength will ensure the agreement is honored by all sides.
Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The popular video sharing app TikTok has returned to app stores at Apple and Google. That's after President Trump delayed enforcement of a ban on the app. It was taken down last month to comply with a law requiring Chinese company ByteDance to divest or see TikTok banned in the U.S. The app has some 170 million U.S. users. Trump has signed an executive order putting off the enforcement until April 5th. The Dow was down 165 points. This is NPR. According to the Vatican, preliminary tests have determined that Pope Francis has a respiratory tract infection and is running a mild fever, though otherwise in good spirits. The pontiff was listed in fair condition at Rome's Gemelli Hospital, where he was taken earlier today. The 88-year-old pope was diagnosed with bronchitis last Thursday, but had been continuing with his official duties. Vatican says it's canceled all events for Francis through Monday. The president of Brazil says he's prepared to reciprocate if the U.S. behaves poorly towards his country. NPR's Kerry Khan reports the South American leader has been relatively quiet about President Trump's tariffs on Brazilian steel and now new threats against ethanol exports.
In a local radio interview, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva said Brazil does not want friction with anyone. But he added, quote, if Trump behaves like this toward Brazil, We will reciprocate in kind. Lula added that Trump is acting like he is sheriff of the world. So far, Brazil has not levied any new import tariffs. Trump slapped 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum imported into the U.S. Brazil is the second largest supplier of steel to the U.S. Trump also announced reciprocal tariffs on all countries. For Brazil, that would affect its large ethanol exports. Lula insists the U.S. and Brazil trade is in balance and does not need protectionist tariffs. Carrie Khan, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
Crude oil futures prices closed lower today with some hopes global supply disruptions could ease if talks aimed at hammering out a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine move forward. Oil fell 55 cents a barrel to $70.74 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Vice President J.D. Vance is representing the Trump administration in Europe. And the Munich Security Conference kicked off today with a speech by Vance. While European leaders were hoping to hear more clarity on the Trump administration's plans for Russia and Ukraine, they received something completely different from the U.S. vice president. We're joined now by NPR Central Europe correspondent Rob Schmitz to talk about that and much more from the very first day of the conference. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, I know it was a packed day in Munich, a lot of news, but I do want to start with Vice President Vance's speech and its, shall we say, cool reception. What did Vance say?
Yeah, it was what Vance did not say that was at first surprising. He didn't mention Ukraine at all, really, just in passing at the start of the speech. And after a week when President Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth had a lot to say about negotiating with Russia to put an end to the war, European leaders were sort of expecting Vance to add some clarity to this. But instead, Vance lectured European leaders about democracy.
Wow. And what did he lecture them on exactly?
So he blamed Europe's political establishment for ignoring people and political parties that are not in the mainstream. In other words, far right or populist parties that in countries like Germany are starting to gain some popularity. Here in Germany, the Alternative for Germany party, a nationalist anti-immigrant party, is left out of government by the country's mainstream parties because they consider it a threat to Germany's democracy. And given Germany's Nazi history, this is a pretty sensitive topic here. But the day after Vance visited a concentration camp, he told Europe's power base here that they should listen more to people in non-mainstream parties like the Alternative for Germany. Here's what he said.
If you're running in fear of your own voters, there is nothing America can do for you. Nor, for that matter, is there anything that you can do for the American people who elected me and elected President Trump.
And Elsa, the European leaders in the room at this point were pretty shocked and confused by this. There was tepid reaction. And at one point, Vance paused after he made a point and nobody applauded. So there was a sort of feeling of awkwardness in the room.
Oof. Okay, well, to go back to Ukraine, if Vance didn't focus on it, did anyone from the U.S. talk about Ukraine at the conference?
Yeah, in a roundtable discussion, Senator Lindsey Graham talked about how under the right circumstances, Ukraine could perhaps become part of NATO someday. But then it was Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's turn to speak, and he took off his translation headphones and he spoke in English about how he saw the issue. He said he'd met with both Presidents Biden and Trump about Ukraine becoming part of NATO. And here's what he said their attitude has always been.
United States, they never saw us in NATO. They just spoke about it, but they really didn't want us in NATO.
And I'll say he's obviously being pretty candid about this, and it's clear from what both President Trump and his defense secretary said this week that Ukraine is not being considered to be a future NATO member by the U.S. leadership.
Yeah, I mean, we heard a lot from the Trump administration this week on Russia and Ukraine, and I'm just wondering, like, how are European leaders characterizing the message they think they're getting from the U.S.?
They're concerned. You know, one speaker who I think summed up Europe's reaction to all this pretty well was from German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier. I've covered him for years, and he usually gives pretty tame speeches, but today he just blasted the new Trump administration in a scathing speech. He called on Europeans to not be paralyzed by Trump's flood of executive orders and announcements, and he said this new U.S. administration holds a totally different viewpoint from Europe's.
Feststeht die neue amerikanische Administration.
He's saying here that it is a worldview that shows no regard for established rules or for partnerships and trust that have grown over a long time. And he said it is not in the interest of the international community to allow this worldview to become the dominant paradigm. And then he said the absence of rules must not be the guiding principle of a new world order. You know, and he finished his speech by criticizing how tech entrepreneurs and populists love to, quote, disrupt the market, and that they think they can do that to democracy too. And he said at the end, democracy is not a business model.
That is NPR's Rob Schmitz in Munich. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Elsa.
For a decade, Deborah Rutter served as president of the Kennedy Center. This week, she was fired from that position. Donald Trump had replaced many board members with his own supporters. And on Wednesday, the new board elected Trump Kennedy Center chairman.
So we took over the Kennedy Center. We didn't like what they were showing and various other things.
This is what he told reporters Monday night.
I'm going to be chairman of it, and we're going to make sure that it's good and it's not going to be woke.
He also told reporters he had never been to a show at the Kennedy Center because, quote, there was nothing I wanted to see. Deborah Rutter is in our studios now to talk about the abrupt end to her tenure. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
How abrupt was it? How did you find out all this was afoot?
I was actually in the basement of the Kennedy Center with my executive assistant, and I got a phone call from a member of the board.
And what was the phone call? What did they tell you? And what went through
your mind?
It was
very short. It was very short and direct. It was from somebody I'd worked with for many, many years.
Did you have any idea this was coming?
Well, I wasn't surprised. There had been a communication saying that an interim executive director would be coming in to meet with me and to work alongside me. I read between the lines a little bit.
The Kennedy Center is prestigious. It's very well known. It is also one institution inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. Why should the rest of the country, the rest of the world care about who's in charge?
So the Kennedy Center is, by congressional mandate, the National Cultural Center. And we have a mandate from 1958 that calls for it to be the National Performing Arts Center and the National Advocate for Arts Education. In 1964, they added the Living Memorial to John F. Kennedy. So this is more than just the local performing arts center. It represents America to the world, and it invites the world to our nation's capital to be a showcase for all of the arts.
To your knowledge, can President Trump do this? Is there any law, any statute that would prevent him from ousting the board, ousting you?
The statute establishes that a 36-member board and a 21-member ex officio board guide the operations of the Kennedy Center and those three peers of our mission. Those 36 are appointed by the President of the United States to serve for a 6-year term. It is silent on whether or not the president can remove them. And it is absolutely clear in our bylaws that the board elects the chairman of the board. So it is unprecedented for the Kennedy Center to have the president of the United States as a member of the board. And it is therefore unprecedented that the board would elect that individual to be chair of the board.
Unprecedented, not necessarily illegal or...
I can't speak to that, but that is what the statute and our bylaws call for.
And just to cut to the chase, it's been, what, 2 days since you were ousted? How are you thinking about things?
I'm really, really, really sad about what happens to our artists, what happens on our stages, and our staff who support them. The Kennedy Center is meant to be a beacon for the arts in all of America, across the country. And we have worked so hard and accomplished so much over this last decade to really broaden the programming, to invite all manner of arts and artists to our stages, and we've expanded our audience as a result. I pray that that can be sustained, but that's my biggest concern.
Renee Fleming, the famous soprano, has announced she is stepping down as artistic advisor. Yesterday, I saw the actor and director Issa Rae says she is canceling what was supposed to be a sold-out show at the Kennedy Center next month. What is your advice to artists going forward? Should they come to the Kennedy Center? Should they perform?
If they have the invitation and they know that the environment is safe for them to express their ideas and their art, absolutely. Our National Cultural Center needs and deserves to be the platform for artists of all sorts, but they have to feel welcome and safe.
That prompts me to ask about a comment that President Trump made. As you know, he criticized the Kennedy Center for being woke. He has also said, and I'm quoting, "No more drag shows or other anti-American propaganda, only the best." Deborah Reuter, how do you understand those words? How do you react?
I am a professional arts attendee. I am a believer in the work of the artist. I am not a propagandist. I am not a politician. Art speaks for itself. Art sometimes doesn't make you feel comfortable, but it is telling the story of who we are. And all artists, as all Americans, have the freedom of expression. I will tell you that we have many, many more people coming to performances today because they see themselves welcome at the Kennedy Center. And that is my concern. How will we be able to sustain what we've done to really throw open the doors and make sure that the Kennedy Center is not just welcoming everybody, but seeing themselves and hearing their stories on our stages? Oh, I used our. I guess it is still our stage. It is, the Kennedy Center still is my cultural center as well.
Deborah Reuter, thank you.
Thank you.
She was president of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts for a decade. This is her first interview after being fired this week.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Two recent executive orders from President Trump address religion directly. One sets up a task force to counter what Trump calls, quote, anti-Christian bias in the federal government. The other establishes or re-establishes a faith office in the White House. Here to walk us through how these orders might work is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Okay, so I want to start with the anti-Christian bias task force. What would that be exactly?
Well, this order says that its purpose is to protect the religious freedoms of Americans and end the, quote, anti-Christian weaponization of the government. The task force will be headed by Attorney General Pam Bondi. Then the order lists some specific instances of what it calls this anti-Christian targeting under the Biden administration. Among them, the Department of Justice prosecuting people who blocked access to reproductive health clinics, and the Department of Education guidance about campus groups that discriminate against LGBTQ people.
Huh. Okay, I guess my question is, how is that anti-Christian bias, like those examples?
Well, certainly not bias against all Christians. There are plenty of Catholics and Protestants who favor abortion rights and believe access should not be blocked. And same with Christians and LGBTQ rights. Professor of Law and Religion Robert Tuttle at George Washington University says what's really being described in this executive order is a specific conservative version of Christianity.
It's about the relationship between Christianity and its perceived mistreatment by the government and the elites that has long been a staple of the Protestant evangelical right.
And Tuttle says this persecution narrative leads to the false idea that Christians are an embattled minority when, in actuality, about two-thirds of the U.S. identifies as Christian. What's really going on here, Tuttle says, is that the loss of Christian hegemony feels like persecution to these evangelicals.
Okay, let's turn to the faith office. I said this executive order establishes or maybe reestablishes the office. What would a faith office do?
Well, an office like this has existed in the White House since 2001 when George W. Bush established what he called the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. It helped faith-based groups navigate getting government grants to do work like run shelters or refugee resettlement programs. Melissa Rogers headed that office under both Obama and Biden. She says the spirit of the office was bipartisan and the office had a clear goal.
The government does a smart thing when it works with these organizations who know how to bring about change in people's life that can be transformational.
It's worth noting this office was mostly dormant during the first Trump administration.
Oh, okay. Well, these moves, Jason, they're coming while a number of religious groups are fighting against the Trump administration, right? Like, what policies are at the center of their concerns?
Well, more than two dozen religious groups, including several large Christian denominations, are suing over one policy in particular. Trump has rescinded the guidance that prevented authorities from entering houses of worship to enforce immigration laws. They say fears of immigration raids are preventing them from living out their faith. Also, the administration has suspended the refugee resettlement program, which is carried out mostly by faith-based organizations. Those groups often resettle Christians fleeing persecution in other countries, and they've had to lay off people doing that work. So while the Trump administration says it's fighting anti-Christian bias, it's also hampering the work that many Christians say they're called to do as part of their faith.
That is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome.
In these days of heavy division, there may be no love lost between Democratic and Republican legislators around the country. But in Wisconsin, a Valentine's Day effort by an elementary school teacher turned lawmaker is a pitch for bipartisanship. Here's Mayan Silver from member station WUWM.
Although she wouldn't call herself that, Deb Andraka is a legislative cupid of sorts.
Hi, can I give you a Valentine?
You can't have a Valentine.
I am.
Andraka is a Democratic state representative from suburban Milwaukee. Sporting a hot pink blazer, she's crisscrossing the Wisconsin state capitol.
I'm handing these all out to my Republican and Democratic colleagues.
Oh, that's very nice of you.
One of those 98 lawmakers, Republican Representative Patrick Snyder, who hails from a village in central Wisconsin. There's a poem rubber banded around his box of conversation hearts.
With our state legislature more evenly split, when we work together, we all benefit. Though one person alone can't fix all frustrations, I hope we might start with bipartisan conversations. Happy Valentine's.
What's your take?
I'm all for it. Doesn't mean we always agree, but you know what? We have to talk and listen.
Up until recently, Wisconsin had some of the most lopsided legislative voting maps in the nation. Republicans got used to controlling the discussions. So when Andraka got to the Capitol, she thought back to a recurring tradition from her past job. Student teaching third graders.
And I thought, wouldn't it be just fun to just distribute some Valentines and maybe spark some conversations across the aisle? So I got out my craft scissors, made some Valentines, made up a rhyme, and I just walked around and tried to make those connections.
One year, she went with Republicans are red, Democrats are blue, but Wisconsin is purple, so I hope to work with you.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Dr. Seuss, and if anybody ever needs a rhyme, I can, you know, pretty much, you know, I can produce one on demand.
After new maps went into effect last year, Democrats flipped 14 seats. But Republicans were still able to keep the majority in both houses. GOP Rep. Snyder thinks of it this way.
You know, one day we'll be in the minority, and I hope that they feel like that, you know, we can go to them and work with them. So I think that's the best for Wisconsin.
But powerful GOP Assembly Speaker Robin Voss doesn't seem so optimistic. Here he is after the November elections, when he was asked about working together.
If the Democrats' compromise is expanding welfare, you know, having kids play or having boys play girls sports and all the craziness that the National Democratic Party stands for, which is echoed by the Democrats here in Madison, no. If it's saying how do we get the money that we think should be back in the hands of the taxpayers in their hands, I'm all ears to do that.
Andraka suggests that her Democratic colleagues stick together.
O'clock. Rep. Jowers, are you here? Do you have a second?
Sure.
Can I give you a lollipop?
For them, she's carrying a bouquet of cherry lollipops.
Hello.
What's up?
Happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, thank you.
Fellow Democratic legislator Alex Jowers chuckles at the message, which says, let's work together on some popular bills.
Representative
some
Alex
popular
Jowers.
Bills.
Andraka says she has no illusions that a Valentine is going to suddenly break Wisconsin's divided government partisan logjam. But she says a small gesture that delivers a smile is a start. For NPR News, I'm Ayan Silver in Madison.
This is NPR News.
In his new film, Universal Language, director Matthew Rankin wants to merge his love of Canadian and Iranian film, despite their incongruencies.
My go-to joke is that Iranian cinema emerges out of 1,000 years of poetry, and Canadian cinema emerges out of 50 years of discount furniture commercials.
That story and the latest news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Aphasia affects your ability to use language,
but often not your ability to sing. We'll meet the Aphasia Choir of Vermont, where music brings joy.
Darkness and lightness, like you can't have one without the other.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The National Transportation Safety Board is updating its investigation into the mid-air collision between a jetliner and an Army helicopter in Washington, D.C. last month. Chairwoman Jennifer Homedy says altitude played a role in the deadly crash.
We are seeing conflicting information in the data, which is why we aren't releasing altitude for the Black Hawk's entire route.
Investigators say some radio transmissions between air traffic controllers and the Black Hawk crew weren't fully heard by the pilots of the helicopter. 67 people died in the collision. The full investigation is expected to take at least a year. The Trump administration is cutting 10% of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's workforce. That's about 1,300 people. NPR's Will Stone reports on the hit to the public health agency.
The layoffs are targeting probationary employees. It's a broad category that includes recent hires and longtime staffers who recently moved to new positions in the CDC. One current CDC employee who requested anonymity because they are not authorized to speak called the decision tragic for the future of the agency. The cuts also hit the Epidemic Intelligence Service, where all those in the first year of their service were laid off. These are CDC's so-called disease detectives, often dispatched to investigate outbreaks and public health threats. A spokesperson at the Department of Health and Human Services told NPR it's taking the action to support President Trump's broader effort to restructure and streamline the federal government. Will Stone, NPR News.
Stocks closed mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 165 points. The Nasdaq Composite was up 81. The S&P 500 closed down a fraction. This is NPR News in Washington. More than 1 million Eagles fans flooded the streets of Philadelphia today to celebrate Sunday's Super Bowl win over the Kansas City Chiefs. Peter Crimmins of member station WHYY reports excited fans lined the parade route to cheer the team on.
Philadelphia is known as the city of brotherly love. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro said Eagles love spreads far beyond Philadelphia.
The Philadelphia Eagles are now America's team.
Some took advantage of the fact that the parade took place on Valentine's Day to make marriage proposals while wearing their jerseys. Adam Gallagher was one of them. He surprised his girlfriend, Lainey Kolesarek, with a ring.
This is like a once-in-a-lifetime thing, like Eagles parade, Valentine's Day. I'm shaking. I'm in shock.
It was just 2 years ago that the Eagles lost the Super Bowl to Kansas City. Many fans said that made this celebration even sweeter. For NPR News, I'm Peter Crimmins in Philadelphia.
Torrential rains have brought flooding and mudslides to parts of Southern California. Forecasters say an atmospheric river has dumped more rain on Los Angeles than the city has seen in nearly a year. The storm triggered evacuation orders and flash flood warnings in many parts of LA County, including areas that were scorched by massive wildfires. I'm Windsor Johnston, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card, VentureX. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. President Trump has been making changes at breakneck speed, and emergency powers are a legal tool helping him to do that. Trump has declared a national energy emergency, and he's used a border emergency to justify tariffs. Those are both firsts. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports.
Declaring a national emergency unlocks 150 additional legal powers for the president. That's according to the Brennan Center, a progressive law and policy organization which took an inventory. Those powers allow a president to act quickly. Take the tariffs Trump imposed on China last week and threatened on Canada and Mexico, citing fentanyl and migrants crossing the border as emergencies. Trump can impose tariffs without an emergency, using powers delegated to him by Congress. He used those in his first term and is using them this time around, too, for aluminum, steel, maybe reciprocal tariffs. But Kellyanne Shaw, a lawyer and former Trump advisor, says that with emergency powers, he doesn't need to follow a process or get public input.
I think from a practical perspective, it gives him the ability to impose tariffs immediately.
Meanwhile, the president has also declared an energy emergency designed to boost production of oil and gas. Kim Lane Shepley, a scholar who has examined emergency powers for decades, says that could speed up energy projects by removing checks and balances.
It eliminates a lot of the environmental protection provisions. It eliminates a lot of the public participation in how these things are going to go.
Trump has declared a border emergency, too, another area where he wants to move fast. But what qualifies as an emergency? On energy, the president cites future supply problems, but the U.S. produces more oil and gas than any other country, and there's no energy shortage now. Well, the National Emergencies Act, which was passed in the 70s, is missing something important.
There's no definition of national emergency in the law.
That's Elizabeth Goitein of the Brennan Center. Her team tallied up those 150 emergency powers. She says logically, emergencies should mean unexpected urgent crises. But without a definition, it's up to the president. So if the president says there's an emergency, courts are unlikely to disagree. The National Emergencies Act was supposed to put limits on emergency declarations. Congress would review them every 6 months, could terminate them at any time, and emergencies would automatically expire.
And essentially, each one of these three safeguards has failed in different ways.
Those regular reviews don't happen. A Supreme Court ruling in 1983 made it very hard for Congress to end an emergency. It takes a two-thirds vote now. And the expiration dates, they just get extended. The country is under dozens of emergencies right now, some of which have lasted for decades. The emergency declared during the Iran hostage crisis is still in place. So is the terrorist threat emergency declared after 9/11. In fact, here's Kim Lane Shepley again.
I don't think there has been a time when we were not in a state of emergency.
Trump tested the limits of these emergency powers in his first term when he declared an emergency to fund his border wall. It was an end run around a divided Congress, which didn't want to give him all the money he asked for, and prompted a bunch of legal fights. Trump won some, lost others, but the Supreme Court never ruled. So the question of whether Trump could do that was never really resolved. And on day one of term two, Trump revived it with another declaration of an emergency at the southern border. Nazak Nikuktar, a lawyer who was in the first Trump administration, says that experience of pushing the limits of power is informing this second term.
I think this time the Trump administration is much more confident and much more emboldened.
This is all about more than tariffs or energy. There are very few checks on a president's emergency powers. The law that's meant to limit them doesn't. And again, courts are reluctant to disagree if the president says there's an emergency. But they might question him on something else. If he's correctly using the powers it unlocks. Former President Joe Biden tried to use the pandemic emergency to justify forgiving student loans, and the Supreme Court said, no, that's not on your list of emergency powers. Border walls and tariffs, those aren't specifically listed either. The courts might decide just how far Trump can go. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
As the Trump administration publicly hammers out its plans on ending Russia's war in Ukraine, it's also pressing Ukraine to make deals in exchange for more aid. One deal in the works involves giving the U.S. the right to mine critical minerals and rare earth metals. NPR's Joanna Kakissis has more from Kyiv.
Rare earth metals are used to produce everything from laptops to cancer treatment drugs. Ukraine has some of the largest in Europe. In interviews, President Trump has said they're worth anywhere between $500 million and $500 billion. Speaking to Fox News earlier this week, Trump said he told the Ukrainians he wants to exchange mineral rights for American aid.
And they've essentially agreed to do that. So at least we don't feel stupid. Otherwise, we're stupid. I said to them, We have to get something. We can't continue to pay this money.
We have some closer remarks. Yes. Okay, thank you very much.
Trump sent his Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to Kyiv earlier this week to talk about a mining deal. Bessent framed it as the U.S. and Ukraine deepening economic ties.
This is an important signal to the world, to the Russian leadership, that we stand together.
Zelensky first brought up the idea to Trump last fall. Speaking at the Munich Security Conference today, Zelensky said such a deal would give Ukraine security guarantees.
We need to protect Ukraine and our resources. Why do we need to protect them? So that they do not fall into the hands of Russia and their allies.
Ukraine has lost raw material deposits in parts of eastern Ukraine now occupied by Russia. Senator Lindsey Graham, who is also in Munich, framed the prospective deal as a way to pressure Russian President Vladimir Putin into concessions.
Let's do the minerals agreement so we'll have our American business interests. Putin doesn't understand what's going on. If we sign this minerals agreement, Putin is screwed. Because Trump will defend the deal.
Volodymyr Landa, senior economist at the Center for Economic Strategy in Kyiv, expects American investors will be interested in two critical minerals, titanium, which is used in aviation, and lithium, which is used in electronics.
If an American company opens not just a mine, but a lithium enrichment factory, for example, that's very good. That's definitely is win-win situation. When American investor will get revenues, will get a predictable supply chain, and Ukraine will get jobs, Ukraine will get taxes.
While some lithium deposits lie in Russian-occupied parts of Ukraine and close to the front line, others are safe. Landa says an Azerbaijani company called Nexel bought the holding rights to two big deposits of titanium this fall. Environmentalists say processing critical minerals creates sludge that, if stored improperly, can contaminate soil and groundwater. Dmytro Kuleba, a former foreign minister in Zelensky's administration, said this can't be a priority for Ukraine as Russia advances.
If I have to choose between the threat of contaminating these territories with Russia or contaminating them with the byproducts of exploration of raw materials, I would definitely go for the second option.
The negotiations on these mining rights, part of a big plan to end the war, are set to continue next week when the Trump administration's special envoy is set to visit Ukraine. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump has taken aim at diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, signing executive orders that seek to end them in the federal government. Even before Trump was reelected, many big companies had been backing away from diversity promises they made in the wake of George Floyd's murder in 2020. KUOW's Noelle Gasca reports on what it all means for DEI consultants.
For the past handful of years, Seattle-based DEI consultant Alma Villegas says she's had a ton of work, so much that she was able to get an estimate of her income and work commitments a year in advance, sometimes even two.
This year, I am nowhere near that. I'm about 50%, and that's really only through, I would say, for the first 6 months of the year.
Viega says this isn't something that emerged all of a sudden under the new Trump administration. She noticed a change all the way back in the summer.
We started seeing less opportunities become available, less opportunities that really mentioned DEI.
She says there was more competition for a shrinking number of consulting gigs. And she's not alone. While one DEI consultant NPR spoke to for the story had seen their work increase, most, like Viegas, had seen it dry up. Also,
we started seeing a change in the language.
When organizations now post online looking for consultants like Viegas, she says they use the words like belonging and inclusion instead of DEI. She decided to remove the acronym from her consulting firm's website.
DEI has been made into a slur.
That's Melina Phillips, a DEI consultant based in Washington, D.C. Phillips says crucial inflection points in the backlash to DEI came even before this summer. She points to the publication of Project 2025, which advocated ending government participation in DEI. Another, she says, was the Supreme Court ending affirmative action in college admissions in June of 2023. She speculates that those actions had an impact on companies.
Industries were now emboldened and kind of given the green light and a roadmap to dismantle DEI initiatives within their institutions.
Half a dozen consultants interviewed for this story said they don't think the backlash means the end of DEI work. Phillips is investing more resources into marketing. She's just launched a podcast to broaden her firm's audience. Other consultants say the work they do might have to look and sound a little different. In Pennsylvania, for example, DEI consultant Dan Kimbrough is carefully going back through his presentation materials. He's looking for any messaging that could raise red flags for DEI skeptics.
And there's one video that I used to show about microaggressions, about mosquitoes and how annoying they were.
Essentially, the video compared microaggressions to mosquitoes, and Kimbrough pulled it because he doesn't want people to feel he's calling them annoying.
I'm more worried now that people who are on the fence or who are very much anti-DEI are searching presentations for specific things.
Even though these consultants say their work is changing and getting more challenging, they also say their commitment to the work remains the same. For NPR News in Seattle, I'm Noelle Gasca.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. There are at least 2 million people in America who have thoughts and ideas they can't put into words. People who have had strokes or traumatic brain injuries often live with aphasia, difficulty using language, both written and spoken. But music mostly originates in the undamaged hemisphere of the brain. People with aphasia can often sing.
I like to hold it in my arms and keep it company.
This is the Aphasia Choir of Vermont, founded more than a decade ago by former speech-language pathologist Karen McPheeters-Leary. And today, for our weekly segment of short-form audio documentaries, we're going to meet one of the members of the choir. The story is brought to us by Erica Heilman from the podcast Rumblestrip.
I think I will know when to come in.
That's Anna King getting ready for her solo with the Aphasia Choir of Vermont. Anna has been living with aphasia for 19 years, struggling with language and with word finding. We take language utterly for granted. We talk and talk. So what is it like to be someone struggling to find words? And how are they met out in the world of talkers, in a world pretty uncomfortable with silence? Here is a tiny window into Anna's world. Welcome.
Chris, I was thinking more of a fade out.
I was exercising when I had this horrible bike accident. Then everything changed. I had to learn how to think again, speak again, talk again, get up again. I was 3 months after I had graduated. I was going to go to UVM for chemistry, but then my life took a different turn. There is a loneliness, but darkness and lightness, you can't have one without the other. And I understand that really deeply.
Whenever I want you, all I have to do is dream.
What are the 18 sort of common ways that people react in moments with people who are struggling to speak?
Don't let them talk. Speak loudly to them. I wish that everyone could be patient.
There's something someone wants to say, and they're not finding the way to say it, and I'm not guessing it. So there's a silence. Mm-hmm. What is the silence, the giving up of the guessing, but just being there anyway? What does that mean to the person who can't speak?
Everything. Yeah. You don't get it, and you just will try and then fail, and you tried. Humankind. Yeah. And you can be kind. Yeah.
The fundamental things of life as time goes by.
What about love?
Oh. That. That really touches me. Yeah. Because my parents love me so much, and my dogs love me. And I think I haven't not experienced. I am kind of not a experience in love, but I think that's what Karen does for us. Like, it brings us all together.
Joy is what you're describing.
Yeah. The experience of getting all in a room and singing. And I think biting into a peach while walking my dogs, like, they just got that this life is precious. Every day, like, you go out and you smell. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
On June 2nd, the Aphasia Choir had their 9th performance to a sold-out audience. It was a hit, of course, because the Aphasia Choir is awesome, but also because Karen had the good sense to pick some excellent songs from the 80s. How did your solo go?
Good. I think it went good.
I want to hear it.
Yeah. Hold on.
Anna pulled up the recording on her phone.
Hold on. Hold on. Hold the phone. Hold the phone. You with the sad eyes, don't be discouraged. Oh, I realize it's hard to take courage in a world full of people. You can lose sight of it all. The darkness inside you may make you feel so small.
See your true colors shining through. I see your true colors, and that's why I love you. So don't be ashamed.
That was Erica Heilman from the podcast Rumble Strip. She is also a reporter for Vermont Public, where a version of this story previously aired.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cunard, sailing to destinations worldwide on Queen Mary II, Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, and Queen Anne, with the goals of relaxation, indulgence, and adventure. Learn more at cunard.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com. And
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Ain't no hold.